Scene 8. Drowning amid uncertainty. It's 1 p.m. Emily has just finished lunch with Rick, the operations manager, and Carl, the company's finance director. The polite chatter about vacation plans is over, and it's time for Emily to present her plan for a new conference. In her old job, she had a predefined budget and would execute a series of well-codified steps involving getting sponsors, organizing speakers, and arranging marketing. In her new role, she creates these budgets and oversees others who run the conference. Her objective is to design 3 new conferences, create budgets for them, and then beat these budgets. New conferences also have to be sold to other leaders in her organization. That's the purpose of this lunch. Emily presents her first big idea, a conference about sustainability. She wants to bring business leaders together to discuss how to improve the long-term viability of companies in the face of economic challenges, climate change, and globalization. Though she's passionate about this topic, she's also anxious about getting the conference approved. There's so much uncertainty, whether the wider business world is ready for this idea, what they could charge attendees, who might speak, and who from her team would be the hands-on manager. She also feels uncertain about giving responsibility for the hands-on tasks to someone else after doing them for so long. Would anyone else do as good a job? Women tend to be better at labeling their emotions. Emily knows she's anxious, yet labeling alone hasn't settled down her limbic system. She still feels more tension than is helpful right now. Rick and Carl unconsciously sense this anxiety, which nudges their own limbic systems into alert mode. They start to question Emily's assumptions. As a result, her limbic system goes into overdrive. Now she's also uncertain why they're questioning her. Don't they trust her judgment? Is it because she's a woman? She senses her choices are being challenged, and she rails at the feeling of not having control of her work. She thinks back to a recent job where she was given a budget and left alone to oversee her domain. The presentation of her next 2 projects doesn't go well. Emily tries hard to label and put aside her frustrations as they arise, but this tactic doesn't seem to be enough. She leaves the meeting, wondering if this promotion is worth the pain. Emily's challenge here is different from Paul's in the last scene. They both have to sell an idea, one of the most stressful parts of any job. Emily is more used to selling, so her limbic system has a lower baseline arousal level for this task than Paul's. He has spent more of his career behind a computer. In Paul's situation, his limbic system was over-aroused by emotions from the past emerging in the present. Emily's limbic system is aroused by her anxiety about the future. The brain craves certainty. A sense of uncertainty about the future and feeling out of control both generate strong limbic system responses. Emily is experiencing both of these threats at the same time during the lunch. For her to succeed in her new role, she needs to change her brain to recognize and deal with stronger emotions than labeling alone can handle. The only certainty is more uncertainty. Think of the brain as a prediction machine. Massive neuronal resources are devoted to predicting what will happen each moment. Jeff Hawkins, inventor of the Palm Pilot, and more recently founder of a neuroscience institute, explains the brain's predilection for prediction in his book On Intelligence. He writes, "Your brain receives patterns from the outside world, stores them as memories, and makes predictions by combining what it has seen before and what is happening now. Prediction is not just one of the things your brain does. It is the primary function of the neocortex and the foundation of intelligence. You don't just hear. You hear and predict what should come next. You don't just see. You predict what you should be seeing moment to moment." There's a popular email containing a paragraph of text with only the first and last letter of each word there, the rest junk. Yet most people can still read the contents. The brain is good at recognizing approximate patterns and making a best guess at what something means. This process of prediction happens with all the senses. It's how you can still hear people in a loud nightclub, for example. We hear even when we can't. This predictive capacity, however, involves far more than just your five senses. Dr. Bruce Lipton, author of The Biology of Belief, says that there are around 40 environmental cues you can consciously pay attention to at any one time. Subconsciously, this number is more than 2 million. That's a huge amount of data that can be used for prediction. The brain likes to know what's going on by recognizing patterns in the world. It likes to feel certain. Like an addiction to anything, when the craving for certainty is met, there's a sensation of reward. At low levels, for example, when predicting where your foot will land as you walk, the reward is often unnoticeable, except when your foot doesn't land the way you predicted, which equates with uncertainty. The pleasure of prediction is more acute when you listen to music based on repeating patterns. The ability to predict and then obtain data that meets those predictions generates an overall torrid response. It's part of the reason that games such as solitaire, Sudoku, and crossword puzzles are enjoyable. They give you a little rush from creating more certainty in the world in a safe way. Entire industries are devoted to resolving larger uncertainties, from shopfront palm readers to the mythical black boxes that can supposedly predict stock trends and make investors millions. Some parts of accounting and consulting make their money by helping executives experience a perception of increasing certainty through strategic planning and forecasting. While the financial markets of 2008 showed once again that the future is inherently uncertain, the one thing that is certain is that people will always pay lots of money, at least to feel less uncertain. That's because uncertainty feels to the brain like a threat to your life. When you can't predict the outcome of a situation, an alert goes to the brain to pay more attention. An overall away response occurs. A 2005 study found that just a little ambiguity on its own lights up the amygdala. Think about someone you've spoken to a few times by phone but never met or seen a picture of. You feel a mild uncertainty about him, yet even this tiny uncertainty seems to alter your interactions. Notice how differently you interact once you know what that person looks like. Uncertainty is like an inability to create a complete map of a situation, and with parts missing, you're not as comfortable as when the map is complete. Consider the uncertainty Emily is experiencing based on whether her sustainability conference proposal will be signed off on. The brain likes to think ahead and picture the future, mapping out how things will be, not just for each moment, but also for the longer term. Emily's brain tries to create two different futures, one where the proposal is signed off on and one where it isn't. Each map is enormous, and holding both in mind at once would be nearly impossible, as they involve similar networks. Emily would find herself switching between two giant maps, an exhausting process in itself. Also, not knowing if her project will be signed off on would feel to Emily as if something were stuck in her decision queue. Once this decision is made, many other decisions that her brain wants to make will be easier. For Emily, the uncertainty of not knowing if she will sell her conference idea, not knowing where and when the conference will be, and not knowing who will run it has reduced her capacity to be her best. Her colleagues notice this. She needs stronger emotional regulation techniques to manage uncertainty. However, before getting to these techniques, let's explore one other factor Emily experienced that made matters worse. Autonomy and the perception of control. As well as anxiety from a sense of uncertainty, Emily also experienced stress from recognizing that her level of control over her work had decreased. She now has to get multiple people to sign off multiple times, and she has to get others to do her work rather than run the conference herself. Though she's in a more senior role, her perception of autonomy, of being able to make her own choices, has decreased. Autonomy is similar to certainty, and the two are linked. When you sense a lack of control, you experience a lack of agency, an inability to influence outcomes, a sense of not being able to determine the future, to predict what will happen moment to moment, emerges. This feeling, of course, generates more uncertainty. However, certainty and autonomy also appear to be individual issues. You can be stressed by a lack of certainty, but still have a lot of autonomy, like Paul, who's his own boss, but can't predict his revenues until he closes deals. Or you can have a lot of certainty from a secure job, but a micromanaging boss may not let you make decisions. A sense of autonomy is a big driver of reward or threat. Steve Mayer at the University of Boulder in Colorado says that the degree of control that organisms can exert over something that creates stress determines whether the stressor alters the organism's functioning. His findings indicate that only uncontrollable stressors cause deleterious effects. Inescapable or uncontrollable stress can be destructive, whereas the same stress that feels escapable is less destructive. Significantly so. Stephen Dworkin, a professor in psychology at the University of North Carolina at Wilmington, studies the way rats are affected by drugs. In one study, a rat gives itself cocaine directly by pressing a lever. The rat dies from lack of food and sleep. The surprising part is what happens when a second rat gets the same dose of cocaine at the same time as the first rat, but not of its own volition. It dies sooner. The difference is a perception of control, or so scientists think. The rats don't say much. Jokes aside, this type of study has been done with electric shocks and other stressors, and even on humans, not to the point of death, of course. Over and over, scientists see that the perception of control over a stressor alters the stressor's impact. And there's more. A study of British civil servants found that low-level, non-smoking employees had more health problems than senior executives. This doesn't make sense intuitively, as senior executives are known to be under a lot of stress. It appears that the perception of choice may be more important than diet and other factors for health. Choosing in some way to experience stress is less stressful than experiencing stress without a sense of choice or control. A number of studies show work-life balance as the main reason people start their own small businesses. Yet small business owners often work more hours for less money than in corporate life. The difference? You're able to make more of your own choices. Yet another study, looking at residents in a retirement home, found the number of deaths was halved in the study group compared to a control group when participants were given three additional choices about their environment. The control group were people on a different floor on the same premises. The choices themselves were not significant, a different plant or a different type of entertainment, for example. Amy Arnston studies the effects of limbic system arousal on prefrontal cortex functioning. She summarized the importance of a sense of control for the brain during an interview filmed at her lab at Yale. The loss of prefrontal function only occurs when we feel out of control. It's the prefrontal cortex itself that's determining if we're in control or not. Even if we have the illusion that we're in control, our cognitive functions are preserved. This perception of being in control is a major driver of behavior. Making choices. Another way of thinking about autonomy is through the lens of being able to make choices. When you sense you have choices, something that used to feel stressful now feels more manageable. Finding that you have choices in a situation reduces the threats from both autonomy and uncertainty. Emily could reduce her stress over a proposal's being approved by remembering she could choose to reschedule her meeting and is choosing to present her ideas today. Even the smallest perception of choice seems to impact limbic system arousal. Imagine you're frustrated by having to hire a new team member and feel you have no choice. If you take a quiet moment and find a positive reason to hire someone, to reduce your long-term workload, for example, your limbic system will shift to more of a toward response. In this toward state, it's much easier to reflect on your situation. This idea of the importance of a perception of choice is easy to test on children, who often rail against a lack of choice. When a child won't go to bed, you might reduce her resistance by giving her back a choice. She can choose whether she's read a book or told a story. This choice can have a big impact. It's the perception of choice that matters to the brain. Studies of teenage behavior show that the terrible teens is not a biological necessity, as a number of cultures don't experience this phenomenon. A study of teenagers in Western cultures found that these teenagers have fewer choices than a felon in prison. Food for thought. Finding a way to make a choice, however small, seems to have a measurable impact on the brain, shifting you from an away response to a toward response. If this seems strange, know that the act of pushing an object away versus pulling the same object toward you also creates this kind of change in the brain. Emotional states are surprisingly easy to change at times. One different word or phrase can make a big difference. If I'm driving in traffic and allow myself to get annoyed at being delayed, in this brain state, small frustrations, such as forgetting a document, become bigger. At some point, my director might kick in. Perhaps I look in the mirror and notice how grumpy I look. I might decide to let go of my frustration and focus on relaxing while I drive, knowing I want to write later that night, which won't happen if I'm exhausted from feeling grumpy. I decide to be responsible for my mental state instead of a victim of circumstances. In the instant that I make this decision, I start seeing more information around me, and I can perceive opportunities for feeling happier, such as remembering to call a friend. This experience is one of finding a choice and making that choice, and it shifts what and how I perceive in that moment. Much has been written about the importance of taking responsibility in life. Responsibility means an ability to respond. Generating a toward response by making an active choice increases your ability to respond to incoming data in adaptive ways. This concept is important for maximizing performance at work, as there are so many situations that can over-arouse the limbic system. This idea of consciously choosing to see a situation differently is called reappraisal, and it's the missing link for Emily at her lunch meeting. Every dark cloud has a sliver of reappraisal. Cognitive reappraisal, reappraisal for short, is the other cognitive change strategy for regulating emotions. A series of studies shows that reappraisal generally has a stronger emotional breaking effect than labeling. Thus, it's a tool for reducing the impact of bigger emotional hits. Reappraisal often goes by other names, such as reframing or recontextualizing. There are all kinds of aphorisms for reappraisal, such as turning a sow's ear into a silk purse or finding the silver lining in a dark cloud. Kevin Ochsner at Columbia University studies the neuroscience of reappraisal, building in part on James Gross's psychological research. There's a famous finding in the psychological literature, Ochsner explains, showing that 6 months later, someone who has become a paraplegic is just as happy as someone who's won the lottery. It seems clear people are doing something to find what's positive in even the most dire of circumstances. The one thing you can always do is control your interpretation of the meaning of the situation, and that's fundamentally what reappraisal is all about. In one of Ochsner's reappraisal experiments, participants are shown a photo of people crying outside a church, which naturally makes participants feel sad. They are then asked to imagine the scene is a wedding, that people are crying tears of joy. At the moment that participants change their appraisal of the event, their emotional response changes, and Ochsner is there to capture what is going on in their brain using an fMRI. As Ochsner explains, our emotional responses ultimately flow out of our appraisals of the world, and if we can shift those appraisals, we shift our emotional responses. While most reappraisal tends to be toward being more upbeat, it's also possible to reappraise negatively, to alter a perspective for the worse. Emily did this at lunch, deciding that her colleagues' questions meant they were questioning her judgment. Remember that perceived dangers pack a punch, so even a small reappraisal in the wrong direction can have quite an impact. Ochsner's research finds that as people reappraise positively, there's increased activation of the right and left ventrolateral prefrontal cortex and a corresponding reduction in activation of the limbic system. This is similar to what Lieberman finds when people label emotions. It turns out that conscious control over the limbic system is possible not by suppressing a feeling, but rather by changing the interpretation that creates the feeling in the first place. One difference between labeling and reappraisal, though, is that while people incorrectly predict that labeling will increase arousal, they correctly predict that reappraisal can reduce arousal. A reappraisal for all seasons. From my own observations, I believe there are four main types of reappraisal. The first type is what happens in the wedding funeral picture experiment. You decide that a threatening event is no longer a threat. We do this type of reappraisal a lot, usually without knowing it. For example, when I'm at an airport walking toward a gate I can't see, I get anxious about missing my flight. Once the gate is in sight and I can see a queue of people, my anxiety drops. I've decided I'm not in danger, and I immediately feel better. This first type of reappraisal involves reinterpreting an event. I am reminded of Philippe Petit, the tightrope walker who walked between the World Trade Center's twin towers in the 1970s. He worked out a way to manage his fear of the height by hiring a helicopter and spending time sitting in its open doorway high above the towers, getting comfortable with being even higher than he was planning to walk. Making his brain decide that it wasn't dangerous 1,000 feet above the towers made it possible to feel safe on the wire below a few days later. The wire no longer felt so high. Think of this type of reappraisal as changing your raw emotional response to an event. The second type of reappraisal is at the heart of many effective management and therapeutic techniques. It goes by the name of normalizing, and it's a widely useful tool. Let's say you're in a brand new job and don't yet have mental maps for even simple things, such as finding stationery or coffee. Everything is new. New means uncertain, which means arousing, which reduces space on your stage. Yet being in a new environment means you need to use your stage a lot. With overworked actors, your ability to label or reappraise, to dampen down the arousal of uncertainty, is harder. In this way, doing anything significantly new can create a negative spiral. This is one of the reasons why change is so hard. Doing things differently can bring about a negative spiral that can feel overwhelming. If Emily had known that it was normal to feel overwhelmed in the first few weeks of a new job, her sense of uncertainty would have decreased. Having an explanation for an experience reduces uncertainty and increases a perception of control. The field of change management builds on the power of normalizing by describing the emotions and stages that occur during change, such as denial or anger, to help people reduce the threat response. When you normalize a situation, be it the stress of a new job or the challenges of bringing up teenagers, you're using a second type of reappraisal. The third type of reappraisal is a little more complex, but essentially, it involves reordering information. The brain keeps information in nested hierarchies. All information is positioned relative to other ideas. This is similar, in a sense, to how an organizational chart looks. Every map in your brain is above some maps and below or alongside others. For example, Emily has valued the map for family as being more important than her map for work. She also values being left alone to do her job more than the idea of working with others. This new job is challenging Emily's ordering of things. She wants to run the sustainability conference, but to do so, she needs to work more with others, yet she values working alone more than with others. Something has to give. By looking afresh at the values she ascribes to situations, Emily might find a way to put a positive spin on working with others, to raise the value of this idea. This kind of reappraisal would result in massive numbers of neurons in her brain being reordered into new hierarchies in relation to massive numbers of other neurons. This cognitive change tends to come with a big release of energy, perhaps due to the amount of reconfiguration going on. Reordering how you value the world changes the hierarchical structure of how your brain stores information, which changes how your brain interacts with the world. The last type of reappraisal is probably the hardest to do, but at times can be the most effective. It's similar to reordering, though appears to require more space on the stage to be applied. It's so easy to become fixed in a way of thinking, as you discovered in the scene on impasses and insights. One of the most common causes of tension between people is someone being fixed in his own world view and not being able to see the world through another person's eyes. When you take another person's perspective, you're changing the context through which you view a situation. This is something Emily could have done at her meeting, perhaps seeing herself through the eyes of her colleagues who didn't yet know much about her, instead of assuming they didn't trust her. Think of this type of reappraisal as repositioning, as you are finding a new position from which to look at an event. It could be from another person's position, or from another country or culture's perspective, or even from a perspective of yourself at another time. Each of these four types of reappraisal, reinterpreting, normalizing, reordering, and repositioning, are techniques people use all the time. With a deeper understanding of the biology behind reappraisal, and thus richer, easier to find maps for these techniques, you can begin to reappraise more often and more quickly, which can significantly increase your ability to stay cool under pressure. Reappraisal as the killer application for emotional regulation. In Act 1, I introduced the idea of being at the top of the inverted U, that optimal level of arousal for making decisions and solving problems. This is a state of quiet alertness, one in which you're able to think on several levels at once. If there's a space for the director to jump in from time to time and observe a mental process as it's occurring, your thinking will improve even more. Okay, so that's the perfect world that none of us lives in. Work involves complex, uncertain, messy tasks. Someone who could not regulate his emotions well would last about an hour in most jobs. Yet while most people have reasonable emotion regulation capacities, they still operate under more arousal than is ideal for peak performance. With too much arousal, the director is hard to find. Without the director, the mind easily wanders, and it's easier for irrelevant audience members to jump on stage and take over. A small amount of overarousal can result in your taking longer to do simple work or missing important insights. It doesn't have to be this way. As you learn more about your brain, it becomes possible to stay calm in just about any situation, including the overwhelming limbic system arousal driven by uncertainty about the future. It's reappraisal that gives you this capacity. Consider what Kevin Oxner said when I asked him about the impact of his reappraisal research on his own thinking. If our emotional responses fundamentally flow out of interpretations or appraisals of the world, and we can change those appraisals, then we have to try and do so. And to not do so, at some level, is rather irresponsible. Let's explore how central reappraisal is to success at work with Emily's situation. She's uncertain if she'll sell her sustainability conference idea to her colleagues, and this thought is making her anxious and ineffective. Going back to Gross's list of emotion regulation options, she could try situation selection by sending someone else to sell the conference idea, but that might not go down so well. She could do situation modification, perhaps by holding the meeting out in the sun in a park, but she might still get anxious there. She could try shifting her attention by not focusing on her anxiety, but her arousal might be too strong for that. She could try to express her emotions, but you can imagine how well that would go down. She could try suppressing her feelings, but she would still be anxious, perhaps even more so, and her colleagues would feel anxious too. The best options for Emily involve cognitive change. Labeling her emotions doesn't seem to be enough, which leaves her with reappraisal. Emily might reappraise by noticing she feels anxious about selling the idea to her colleagues and deciding that she doesn't need to sell to them at all. She decides to ask for their help instead. Or she might decide to consider her colleagues as people who will notice things she hasn't been able to see for herself, so that when she presents to the CEO, she will have covered all the angles. Changing her interpretation of the event in one of these ways will probably change the outcome of the meeting, resulting in the holding of an important conference that wouldn't happen otherwise. Perhaps Oxner is right. Sometimes it's irresponsible not to practice reappraisal. The research on reappraisal shows that it's a strategy with few, if any, downsides and significant upsides. Gross did another study outside the lab where he grouped hundreds of people based on whether they tend to use reappraisal or suppression to deal with emotions. He then compared these two groups on a wide range of tests, including optimism, environmental mastery, positive relationships, and life satisfaction. On every factor, those who reappraised more were significantly better off than those who suppressed. Gross also found that men suppress more than women. Perhaps men generally think it's not manly to tell oneself stories about the world and prefer to grin and bear it. There is a substantial body of research which suggests that older adults are better than younger adults at emotion regulation, Gross explains. Teenagers' ability to express their emotions is one of their most wonderful and terrifying qualities. As teens get older, whether they learn to suppress or reappraise as their main emotion regulation strategy may be one of the significant factors behind their future well-being. Gross, with the wonderful understatement of a pure scientist, says, "It looks as though reappraisal is a fairly efficient way of cutting down the experience and biological representation of negative emotion." He may be too subtle. To me, reappraisal is one of the most important skills needed for success in life, the other being the ability to observe your mental processes. When I asked Gross what he thought about reappraisal and its role in education and wider society, he was more effusive. "I think this knowledge should be taught early and often. It should be in the water we drink." Yet while it may sound like reappraisal is the way to bring about world peace and end hunger, this technique also poses some challenging philosophical questions. In 2007, I presented the research on reappraisal to doctors at a cancer research institute. "Are you trying to say," a senior scientist challenged me, "that success at work is based on your ability to make up false interpretations of the world instead of dealing with reality?" I had to pause and reflect for several moments before answering. Research shows that people who see life through slightly rose-colored glasses do, in fact, seem to be the happiest. And happy people perform better at many types of work. The answer to the doctor's question is basically yes, though, of course, one can take this too far. To a logical, fact-based scientist, this answer can be difficult to accept. Reappraisal requires cognitive flexibility, the capacity to see things from many angles, which more creative types tend to be good at. To a technician, the idea of creatively seeing other perspectives is not just illogical, but also perhaps just a little foreign, and therefore a little uncertain. However, there is another angle to this, a reappraisal, if you like. Consider this quote from one of the great neuroscientists, Walter Freeman. "All the brain can know, it knows from inside itself." If you recognize that all interpretations of the world are only that, interpretations your brain has made, and ultimately just yours, then having a choice about which interpretation you might use at any moment makes more sense. There is some bad news about reappraisal, which partially explains why it's not everyone's tool of choice. Reappraisal is metabolically expensive. It's not easy to do, especially if your stage is full or your actors are tired. With reappraisal, first you have to inhibit your current way of thinking, which requires a lot of resources. Next, you have to generate several alternative ways of thinking, each a complex map, and hold these alternatives in mind long enough to make a decision among them. Then you have to choose the alternative interpretation of events that makes the most sense, and keep focused on that. This all points to the need for a strong director. Without the capacity to use your full cognitive power at will, your capacity to reappraise will be limited to moments when you are well rested. The effort involved in reappraisal explains why it tends to be easier to reappraise with someone else. Many of the tools and techniques in mentoring, coaching, career counseling, or various therapies attempt to change your interpretation of events. Another person sees things about you that you can't. It's like having a bonus prefrontal cortex. The other way to make reappraisal easier is through practice. The more you practice reappraisal, the less effort it takes, as you develop thicker networks between the prefrontal cortex and the limbic system. Coaching helps people practice reappraisal, and some brain training tools can help too. Optimists may be people who have embedded an automatic positive reappraisal to life's knocks. Optimists dampen their over-arousal before it kicks in, always looking at the bright side before a nagging doubt takes over. Humor may also be a form of reappraisal. John Case, a retired CEO I know, had a phrase he used when people got tense in a meeting. "Did I tell you I just got a great deal on car insurance?" Out of context, this comment made people crack up, which shifted their perspective from serious to funny, from away to toward. You have probably noticed how much easier it is to see options when you laugh at an otherwise tough situation. With humor, you don't need that cognitively expensive step within reappraisal of trying to scroll through lots of alternative perspectives and come up with the perfect new perspective that triangulates all your different objectives. Just choose the perspective that makes you chuckle. In this way, I like to think of humor as a type of cheap reappraisal. Reappraising your own brain. Let's take this to another level. Frustration at your limitations, mistakes, missed opportunities, forgetfulness, or bad habits can generate a lot of limbic activity. A common automatic response when people get annoyed with themselves is to try to suppress this feeling, to push aside the internal frustration. But you now know what suppression can do for emotions. This brings us to a central idea for this audiobook. As you learn more about your brain, you begin to see that many of your foibles and mistakes come down to the way your brain is built. You can't think about a complex work situation and walk around the house at the same time, which I discovered the hard way, jamming my toes under the door. It's not you. It's your brain. You can't learn to do anything new and complex, such as learn to ride the subway in Japan without an interpreter, without your limbic system firing up from uncertainty. And in this state, you're going to make mistakes, which I also learned the hard way, getting rather lost one day. It's not you. It's your brain. And you can't go into a meeting at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and expect yourself and everyone else to come up with brilliant ideas. It's not you or them. It's your brain. So next time you're tough on yourself, you can say, "Oh, that's just my brain." This statement is an act of reappraisal in itself. This approach may be a far better strategy than trying to express your emotions. And it's probably much better than trying to suppress your frustration about your own foibles. With all this in mind, let's see how Emily's lunch might have gone if she'd noticed she was feeling uncertain and out of control and had found a way to reappraise to reduce her strong arousal. Drowning Amid Uncertainty, Take 2. It's 1 p.m. and lunch has just finished. Emily presents her first big idea, a conference on sustainability. She wants to bring business leaders together to discuss how to improve long-term viability of companies in the face of climate change and globalization. Though she's passionate about this topic, she's also anxious about getting the conference approved. There's so much uncertainty, whether the wider business world is ready for this idea, what they could charge attendees, whom they might get to speak, and who from her team would be the hands-on manager. She also feels uncertain about turning over responsibility for the hands-on tasks to someone else after having done them for so long. Would anyone else do as good a job? Emily notices that all this uncertainty is increasing her anxiety, an act of labeling her emotions which helps a little. Next, she tries to veto her attention focusing on her anxiety, but this doesn't seem to shake her state. She has to find another way to view her situation. She reflects for a moment and sees a few ways she could view this meeting and settles on one idea. That it's a chance to get to know her new bosses and see how she might best work with them. She has reinterpreted the situation, and with this type of reappraisal, her limbic system dampens down. Emily notices Rick and Carl questioning her assumptions, and is about to get defensive when she decides to veto the defensive feeling, which she's able to do in this calmer state. She reappraises the situation, this time looking at herself from Rick and Carl's perspective, a type of repositioning. From this point of view, she can see it would be important that her bosses look closely before investing serious company funds, especially with someone new creating the budget. They will probably cut her slack after she proves herself. With this in mind, she doesn't react defensively to their questions. And the questions stop after a few minutes. She presents all three conferences well and feels pleased with her performance. By the end of the hour, they have agreed in principle to the sustainability conference and decided on a date for the event. She's ready to present the idea to her team and to choose who might be the best person for the job. Surprises about the brain. Certainty is a primary reward or threat for the brain. Autonomy, the feeling of control, is another primary reward or threat for the brain. Strong emotions generated by certainty and autonomy may need more than labeling to be managed. Reappraisal is a powerful strategy for managing increased arousal. People who reappraise more appear to live better lives. Some things to try. Watch for uncertainty creating a feeling of threat. Practice noticing this. Watch for a feeling of reduced autonomy creating a sense of threat. Practice noticing this. Find ways to create choice and a perception of autonomy wherever you can. Practice reappraisal early when you feel a strong emotion coming on. You can reappraise by reinterpreting an event, or reordering your values, or normalizing an event, or repositioning your perspective. Reappraising your own experience is a powerful way of managing internal stressors. Use this technique when you're anxious about your mental performance by saying, "That's just my brain."